chair defends of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today. Iran, a place whose story is far more complex than the headlines suggest. Over the past four decades, the country has quietly engineered one of the most dramatic transformations in public health anywhere in the world. In 1979, life expectancy in Iran was just 56 years. Today, it stands at 75, a 19-year leap. For comparison, during the same period, life expectancy in the United States rose only 3 years, and in France, 8. The numbers tell a story of rapid, determined progress, built on investment in healthcare, expanded insurance coverage, and a national push for better medical services. It's an undeniable sign of Iran's progress and capabilities in the medical field. One of the clearest indicators of a nation's health is maternal and infant mortality. Following the victory of the Islamic Revolution, as access to clinics and trained medical staff increased, Iran saw maternal deaths fall to 20 per 100,000 live births. That's less than 1% of the global rate, which stands at roughly 200 per 100,000. Specialists in obstetrics and gynecology call it one of the country's quiet medical revolutions.
Still, some critics abroad often claim that Iran is a country that is defined only by its drones and missiles. But a deeper look inside the country's scientific institutions paints a very different picture.
Mr. Mohammad Reza Kompani, CEO of a high-tech medical equipment company, outlined how Iran's medical equipment sector has expanded since the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
The medical equipment of Iran has actually been started from the revolution, after the revolution. Before that, we had only the furnitures and such things and autoclave for sterilization of the goods. But after that, about 10 years after the revolution, right after the ending the war, the medical equipment started the industry in Iran. And now, which I'm here, we have about 85% of the items are required to be used in the hospitals. I'm talking about the devices, because in medical equipment, we have two parts, the devices and the sundries and the disposables we used in the hospitals. So in the medical equipment, the devices, 85% of the hospitals are doing the equipping by the Ministry of Health are provided from the local manufacturers. It's the, as you see here, it's the operation room, the ICU, CCU, the dialysis section, the emergency, and the general hospital.
Iran's global ranking in science and research has climbed to 15th. 65 Iranian universities are now counted among the world's top institutions, 22 of them in medical sciences. Many cancers once considered fatal in Iran are now routinely treatable. 97% of the medicines Iranians use are produced inside the country. And through advanced transplants from cord blood to bone marrow, Iranian physicians now treat more than 70 diseases that once required travel abroad. In an interview with us, Iranian scientist Sepide Mirzayi Varzaghani, a Mustafa Prize laureate for scientists under 40 and a leading researcher in cancer drug resistance, highlighted Iran's giant leap in advanced therapeutic technologies, particularly in the field of gene therapy.
با دانشی که داریم و اینکه در حوزه زیست پزشکی ما امروز در دنیا حرف برای گفتن داریم و
With the expertise we have today, Iran has a real voice in the global biomedical arena. We've made significant progress in advanced therapeutic technologies, especially gene therapy. If there is sustained targeted investment, Iran can definitely become a regional hub for cancer research and cancer treatment.
Four decades ago, Iran ranked 39th in global scientific output. Today, it's 18th. In medical sciences alone, Iran has climbed from 38th to 10th worldwide. The country is among the five global leaders in advanced stem cell science, second in the world in bone marrow transplantation, and among the top 10 nations in nanotechnology, biotechnology, and infertility treatments. In biotechnology, Iran is now one of only three nations producing a wide portfolio of high-tech biopharmaceuticals, including the hepatitis B vaccine, erythropoietin, multiple interferons, streptokinase, GCSF, and others. And for more than 20 years, Iran has practiced clinical cell therapy, an area where many countries remain stuck in the research stage. Stem cells are now used in corneal, cardiac, skin, and other transplants across Iranian hospitals. Ms. Mirzayi also explained how her research on drug resistance in cancer led to her receiving the Mustafa Prize. The Mustafa Prize, founded in 2012, is considered one of the most prestigious science and technology awards in the Islamic world.
Can you please tell us more about your research that resulted in you receiving the Young Scientist Mustafa Prize?
پژوهش‌هایی که من انجام دادم و در واقع منجر شد به دریافت این جایزه ارزشمند.
My research, which led to this valuable award, focuses on drug resistance in cancer. I study the role of intercellular signaling pathways that cause cancer cells to become resistant to chemotherapy. These molecular pathways inside the cell play a crucial role. After several treatment cycles, they can make the patient's body less responsive to anti-cancer drugs and reduce the sensitivity of cancer cells therapy. What we're trying to do is to identify and regulate these signaling pathways. Cancer cells can activate certain pathways that, in turn, lower their sensitivity to treatment. By mapping and modulating these pathways, we aim to reduce drug resistance and restore or even increase the responsiveness of cancer cells to anti-cancer drugs.
Education has played a major part in this transformation. Iran now has nearly 70 medical universities and faculties, staffed by 22,000 faculty members.
The country's medical system hosts about 270,000 domestic students and 7,000 international students. Researchers in these institutions have authored more than 60,000 conference papers, 81,000 journal articles, and over 258,000 papers published internationally. 25 Iranian medical universities have been included in the Leiden Ranking 2025, with Tehran, Shahid Beheshti, Tabriz, Shiraz, and Iran University of Medical Sciences ranking below 500 globally. Women's enrollment in universities has also increased, and women now make up 50% of students and faculty, an important accomplishment. Many of these graduates have achieved prominent national and international positions.
Iran's push for scientific independence shows up in its pharmaceutical sector as well. For instance, 99% of medications are produced domestically.
Iran also produces 40% of its medical equipment and requires no outside technical assistance for the development of pharmaceutical formulations, something the country demonstrated during the Iran-Iraq War, the COVID-19 pandemic, and other crises. From 35 dependency-heavy drug companies in 1979, Iran has grown to more than 200 domestic pharmaceutical manufacturers today. Mr. Kompany also described how Iran weathered the COVID-19 pandemic using medical equipment supplied by domestic knowledge-based companies.
I'm telling you that for the rest of the products and the items which we have not produced yet, many, many science-based companies, which among of the 400 are working on them, and I will promise you in about two or three next year, we will have them as well. So there is no worry about the medical equipment, as we didn't have any problem during the corona. You see, in corona, we actually expend 6,000 ICU beds for the corona patients. So this means that we had the knowledge, we had the technology, we had the units, and all of them prevent us to choose the patients from the age and etc. to take it to the ICU. So every patient which needed to go to ICU, freely they could go. Then they hadn't had any problem. So Corona was the one among the 10 to 15 countries in the world which has no problem. Iran was one of them.
Iran now ranks first in Asia in the production of recombinant medicines, drugs used to treat cancers, MS, hemophilia, and viral illnesses. Vaccination coverage for children under 5 has risen from 20% before 1979 to full nationwide coverage, even in remote villages. Iran has produced key pharmaceutical raw materials for treatments of pulmonary hypertension, coagulation disorders, and chemotherapy. It has introduced the first nanotechnology-based injectable anti-cancer drug, Sinadoxazom, among a long list of other high-tech drugs. Iran is now one of the world's top three producers of radiopharmaceuticals, about 70 varieties. These supply 230 treatment centers and 6,500 nuclear medicine units inside Iran and are exported to 15 countries, generating roughly $70 million annually. The only remaining imports are certain raw isotopes, mainly from Russia. Ms. Mirzayi also explained how combination therapies can ultimately help increase hope and survival prospects for cancer patients.
What are some of the practical and clinical applications of your research regarding the diagnosis or treatment of cancer in the near future?
اینها جزء درمان‌های در واقع درمان‌هایی که ترکیبی هستن و طراحی داروهایی که
These are part of what we call combination therapies and gene-based drug designs. Treatments that combine conventional anti-cancer drugs with genetic components. They can be highly effective in preventing and overcoming drug resistance, which is one of the biggest challenges in cancer treatment. We also focus on targeting personalized therapies so that one standard drug is not prescribed for all patients. Instead, treatment is tailored to each patient's genetic profile, because even two people with, for example, lung cancer can have very different patterns of drug resistance. Designing targeted drugs for each individual can significantly improve treatment outcomes, reduce overall costs, and most importantly, increase hope for patients living with cancer.
We have a lot more to cover today, but first let's take a moment to catch up on the latest headlines.
Hello everyone, welcome to the news section of this program. Here we'll go over some important news headlines. Tehran Times. Over 1,140 Iranians among world's 1% most cited researchers. A total of 1,142 Iranian researchers have been recognized among the world's top 1% most cited researchers in 2025, compared to 1,056 identified researchers in 2024, according to the Islamic World Science Citation Institute. The Ministry of Health, Treatment and Medical Education accounts for 52.77% and the Ministry of Science, Research and Technology with 427 researchers, represents 37.43% of the most cited Iranian researchers, ISCIIR reported. Clinical medicine with 446 entries, engineering with 209 entries, pharmacology and toxicology with 163 entries, chemistry with 140 entries, neuroscience and behavior with 115 entries, agriculture sciences with 100 entries, and social sciences with 77 entries held the highest shares of the most cited researchers. Three Iranian researchers have been among the highly cited award recipients. IRNA, Iran among top 20 countries in medical science output, ISC. Iran ranks among the top 20 countries in terms of medical science publications, indexed in the Scopus and Web of Science databases in 2023, according to figures from the Islamic World Science Citation Center. Given the importance of the health and medical fields and the advancements made by Iran in these areas, the ISC has prepared a report on the scientific and technological outputs in this sector, as well as on the most cited researchers and the global rankings of Iranian medical universities, ISC head Ahmad Fazilzadeh said on Saturday. Fazilzadeh pointed out that in comparison of different subject areas and the Web of Science databases, Iranian medical and health researchers have 158,678 documents in their names and the second highest scientific output from the country after engineering, technology, and natural sciences. ISNA, Iran among top three in radiopharmaceuticals expands nuclear scanners nationwide. Iran has established its position as one of the world's top three producers of radiopharmaceuticals, with statistics showing a nationwide increase in nuclear medicine imaging systems across all 31 provinces, according to reports. Radiopharmaceuticals technology, one of the major achievements of modern medicine, has driven significant advancements in diagnosing and treating complex diseases such as cancer over recent decades. Currently, Iran produces 70 types of radiopharmaceuticals, meeting the needs of more than 6,500 nuclear medicine centers nationwide. The country also exports these products to 15 countries, generating around $70 million in revenue in 2025. As part of efforts to achieve self-sufficiency, a cyclotron has been installed and commissioned at a hospital in Tehran to produce radioisotopes used in PET imaging. Mehr, Iran ranks 17th in world in science production, minister. Iran's Minister of Science, Research and Technology, Hossein Simoisarov, says that Iran is ranked 17th in the world in terms of production of the scientific articles. He made the remarks on the sidelines of the cabinet session on November 12th, where he emphasized that the country is at the 17th rank in the world in the field of science production. The minister promised that his ministry would take effective steps to promote the level of science production on the regional and international stage. And thank you for joining us in this section. Please do stay tuned for the main narrative.
Medical tourism has become another thriving industry. In 2024, nearly a million patients from 160 countries traveled to Iran for treatments ranging from infertility and cosmetic surgery to cardiac care, ophthalmology, and organ transplantation. Diako Abbasi, Secretary of the Health Tourism Council, explained how Iran has become a destination for health tourism.
Over the past two decades, Iran has become one of the leading health tourism destinations in the region and even the world. This growth stems from our scientific and technological progress in medicine, the strong expertise of Iranian doctors in diverse specialities, Iran's strategic location near countries with serious healthcare challenges, and our shared cultural background and long medical tradition. All of this has helped make Iran a distinctive and attractive destination for health tourism.
The country also maintains one of the region's largest research networks, with 849 medical research centers. These laboratories fuel Iran's growing scientific partnerships abroad and boost its presence in global health diplomacy.
We currently have around 300 hospitals licensed to provide international health services, fully capable of admitting foreign patients at a professional level. Their staff receive cross-cultural training and they have dedicated international patient departments that operate under official authorization. In addition, there are about 700 active health tourism offices and companies that handle medical visas as well as patients' accommodation, transfers, and specialized guidance during their stay.
In ophthalmology, Iranian hospitals offer services on par with the most advanced nations. The country no longer sends patients abroad for eye care. Instead, patients from neighboring countries come to Iran for surgery due to lower costs, modern equipment, and highly trained surgeons.
Last year, our medical centers admitted foreign patients from around 140 countries, which shows just how strong and promising Iran's health tourism market is. Most international patients come from cardiology and cardiovascular surgery, orthopedics, infertility treatment, transplants, ophthalmology, and ENT procedures such as cochlear implants, as well as cosmetic and general surgeries. They travel from countries like Iraq, Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, the Persian Gulf states, even Saudi Arabia, as well as European countries such as the UK and Germany. We've also received patients from countries like India and even from the United States and Australia. Our data clearly show that Iran is now treating patients from across the world.
Before the victory of the Islamic Revolution, more than 11,000 Iranians were sent abroad each year for medical care. Today, the flow has reversed. The country has performed over 50,000 kidney transplants, around 7,000 heart transplants, and 225 pediatric heart transplants. Every month, roughly 80 million medical services are delivered across the country. In recent years, Iran has also joined the list of medical equipment exporters. Officials announced at the Iran Health 2025 exhibition that Iranian-made medical technology is now shipped to more than 60 countries. More than 17,000 medical technologies have been registered inside Iran, and many are already on the global market. From vital sign monitors and defibrillators to dental and laboratory equipment, as well as precision surgical tools. Mr. Kompany also elaborated on the export of Iranian medical equipment products.
As we are meeting all the standards, international standards of the medical equipment for our product, as the MOH has based on that. So we now have a very good quality devices and also the disposables in the country. So we have no problem for that, and we are exporting about to 40 countries, and we are earning a lot of money among this exporting. And also, we have our own production line in different countries, and by doing the rebranding, by the cooperation of the local agents and our companies in Iran, we have about in countries like Indonesia, Turkey, Iraq, Sweden.
About 65% of Iran's medical device industry is powered by knowledge-based companies, many of which born in universities and science parks. This pipeline of engineers and researchers has allowed Iran to develop high-tech devices such as AI-enhanced MRI machines, portable imaging units, and remote patient monitoring systems.
And there we have the Iranian ICU, which we have the ventilator, the special beds, the patient care monitoring system, and the gas supply. And as I told you during the corona, all this set was equipped from the local manufacturer, so we didn't have problem. And the price was very attractive because at the corona, many countries has to pay 10 times, 8 times of the real price of the ventilator. But here This unit was given to the MOH for 7,000 euro. But we had many offers from other companies, like 50,000, 70,000, 40,000, different prices. But 6,000 of this unit was bought for only at the price of the 7,000 euro, which was very good. And now the real price in the world is about 10 to 12,000 euro.
Exports of medical equipment surpassed $500 million in 2024 and are projected to reach about $650 million by the end of 2025. West Asian and African countries are the largest buyers. The appeal: Iranian devices typically cost 30 to 40% less than their European counterparts, but offer comparable precision and reliability.
The quality is very good because they are meeting all these standards, international standards, and of course the price. For example, this operation room, the general operation room you see here, if you want to buy from a top brand company, European or American, you have to pay at least $200,000 to $300,000 US. But here you can get it for $70,000 US. So you see the different price.
And is it the same quality? So
it is.
You get the same quality, but for a lower price.
Of course, of course. This is our advantage to entering to the market in international markets. So by having the people outside to cooperate with us, we will very soon will be anywhere in the world for the manufacturing of medical equipment and rebranding it.
Years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iran's healthcare system continues to grow. Through decades of expansion, from hospitals and clinics in major cities to health centers in the most remote villages, the promise of equitable healthcare has been largely realized. And for millions of people across the country, that promise has become a lived reality. That's all for today. Until next time, take care.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio from Tehran. We are glad you could join us. I'm your presenter for the next hour. We start off this hour's programs with our varied radio productions feature. After that, we have A to Z of Life. The program presents an Islamic Iranian lifestyle in a variety of ways, making use of ayahs of the Holy Quran, as well as inspirational poetry and stories. And our final program this hour is again our radio productions feature. Stay with us for the next hour.
alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
May peace, blessings, and God's mercy be with you all. Everything mentioned so far serves merely as an example of the manifestations, outcomes, and some consequences of direct American hegemony over Iraq since the military invasion in 2003, particularly in the economic, financial, and oil sectors. Having examined the background and causes of this domination, we will now delve into the origins of comprehensive American hegemony over Iraq and its roots. For over a century, although the occupiers of our lands have changed and the slogans and justifications for occupation and invasion have evolved, the fundamental goal remains unchanged: to dominate our territories, their resources, and the Arab world. This reality is not exclusive to Iraq, but extends throughout the entire region, from British and French colonialism after World War I to American hegemony in both its old and modern forms. The American hegemony in Iraq is an extension of colonial history. The U.S. intervention did not start with the 2003 invasion or the sanctions imposed in 1990. The true American hegemony has lasted for over 70 years. Although it was not exhaustive or complete at the beginning, it specifically began with the precursors to the establishment of the Baghdad Pact in 1955. Even though the United States was not a partner in the pact, it did support it. This agreement was established under the pretext of confronting communist movements and Arab nationalism led by Egypt under the leadership of Gamal Abdel Nasser. If we look further back, even before the Baghdad Pact, we can assert that the strategy of American hegemony has been deeply entrenched. Even Noam Chomsky, in an article titled Modern American Imperialism, the Middle East and Beyond, published on April 24, 2008, traces the history of American hegemony back to before the Spanish-American War of 1898, suggesting that the United States is inherently a hegemonic power, as we discussed in previous episodes, most recent one being on November 28, 2025, titled The United States in Our Lands, Neither to Defend Israel Nor to Confront Iran. Looking back a bit in history to analyze the roots of the global hegemony that led to the domination of Iraq, imperialism began its transformation from its classical form in the 19th century, shifting from traditional military occupation to a global system of economic and political dominance. At the start of this transformation, powers like Germany, Japan, and the United States emerged to compete with Great Britain and other European nations for influence. Europe was thrust into a frantic race for the division of Africa and the control of markets and finances. These factors, along with others, led to the outbreak of World War I. After this war, the Treaty of Versailles marked a second phase of imperialism aimed at dividing the spoils and confronting communism. However, this project was interrupted by the Great Depression, which began with the collapse of the U.S. stock market in 1929 and World War II. With the conclusion of World War II, the leadership of colonial powers shifted from Great Britain to the United States. The United States later developed the Greater Middle East Initiative, a plan aimed at ensuring complete control over the strategic centers of the global economy under the guise of openness and free trade. This shift in leadership saw American imperialism take on new forms, such as international financial institutions, the monetary system, military alliances, and indirect interventions. Control over nations began to be exercised under the pretense of global order, no longer labeled as occupation. Focusing specifically on Iraq, following the end of World War I and the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, Britain discovered a geographical and economic treasure. It occupied Iraq in 1917 and established a mandate system endorsed by the League of Nations. However, the truth is that this mandate was nothing more than a form of real colonialism disguised as a diplomatic document with a dedication signed by the League of Nations. London solidified its control over Iraqi oil through the Iraq Petroleum Company, shaping the modern state's map to serve its strategic interests. This design involved imposing a foreign king, Faisal I, and establishing an army primarily tasked with protecting the British crown rather than ensuring the safety of the Iraqi people. Despite popular uprisings in Iraq, particularly the 1920 revolution,
Britain maintained its grip through political treaties, economic dominance, military presence, and infiltration of the ruling elites. In this way, Iraq emerged as a nominally independent and sovereign state, but in practice, it was subordinate to the British crown. After the conclusion of World War II, Washington stepped onto the stage, taking advantage of the decline of the British Empire and the rise of the United States as a global power. Iraq became a crucial piece in the conflict between East and West. The United States supported the Baghdad Pact in 1955, seemingly to contain the Soviet Union, and attempted to infiltrate the Iraqi army and administration. It employed political and media tools to undermine any nationalist projects that threatened its interests, particularly in the oil sector. With the 1958 revolution and the fall of the monarchy, it seemed that Iraq was beginning to break free from its colonial legacy. Despite its shift towards Arab nationalism or its adoption of this under the leadership of Abdel Karim Qasim and later the Ba'ath Party, Iraq remained a constant testing ground for American influence. This was exerted through conditional aid, intelligence agencies, and even through the manipulation of the head of state himself, such as Saddam, whom Washington used in the 1980s as a tool against Iran before he became a target to eliminate. Since the mid-20th century, the United States' policy towards Iraq has had a consistent goal to keep the country within its regional and global interests and to prevent Iraq from becoming an independent state that could pose a potential threat to those interests. The methods used have been diverse, ranging from covert interventions to economic pressures, military dominance, and control over institutions. Nevertheless, the ultimate aim has always remained the same, to ensure U.S. access to vital resources, especially oil, and to keep Iraq within the sphere of American influence. The initial tools of hegemony were intelligence and covert intervention. In the 1950s and 1960s, there were signs of U.S. support for elements and factions within the Iraqi army and for political movements capable of shifting the internal balance of power when necessary. We recall here the U.S. role in the Ba'ath Party coup and its rise to power in 1963. Another tool, both then and now, is tactical and economic support for regimes or leaders with whom collaboration can be established to achieve U.S. interests. For instance, in the 1980s, with the outbreak of Saddam's war against Iran, the United States reopened diplomatic and commercial channels with Iraq. The United States reopened diplomatic and commercial channels with Baghdad, providing intelligence data, indirect support, and at times direct assistance to Saddam's regime. If covert influence or alliances failed, Washington would turn to economic power, international pressure, and even military force. Following Saddam's invasion of Kuwait in 1990, an international military campaign led by the United States was launched under the banner of liberating Kuwait. Although the stated goal was to free an independent state, the real aim was to control another country and ultimately establish a permanent military presence in the Persian Gulf while securing its oil. Washington led a massive coalition and enforced a suffocating embargo on Iraq for 13 years. This embargo devastated the infrastructure, weakened society, and paved the way for a phase of total domination. Programs like Oil for Food illustrated how international restrictions limited and fragmented the Iraqi state's ability to manage the resources of the Iraqi people. In 2003, the U.S. invasion of Iraq became the most perilous step due to the negative consequences for Iraq, its people, and the entire region. The project to strangle and control Iraq was based on the falsehood of spreading democracy and misleading claims of weapons of mass destruction. The American forces burst into Iraq to overthrow the regime and the Iraqi state within weeks. The Iraqi army was disbanded, institutions were dismantled, and the doors were wide open to sectarianism, corruption, and the systematic plundering of wealth. In reality, the American occupation of Iraq was the culmination of a century of colonial policies. Among the strategies employed by Washington was political control through a quota system that ensured the division and fragmentation of the elite, thereby preventing the establishment of an Iraqi state modeled after a unified national state. Secondly, economic dominance is achieved through the privatization of a significant portion of the public sector and the connection of Iraq to international financial institutions. This results in the Iraqi economy becoming reliant on debt and imports. Thirdly, military and security influence is achieved through the training and equipping of the army and security forces, the establishment of permanent military bases, and the signing of strategic partnership agreements. Fourthly, cultural and media penetration is achieved through the promotion of the liberal democracy model based on American standards, along with support from media networks and civil society organizations that are funded to sway public opinion. In fifth place, the management of natural resources is carried out, particularly regarding oil, through long-term contracts that ensure the ongoing control of Western companies over every production and marketing. In sixth place, support is provided to sectarian, regional, tribal, or clan parties and leaders with the aim of fragmenting the political landscape and limiting the space for inclusive national action. In seventh place, international institutions, particularly the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Bank, WB, are used to dictate the terms of reconstruction and debt, imposing structural economic reforms that undermine the Iraqi state's ability to make independent decisions. As noted, the American plan and methods for domination over Iraq are an extension of the country's colonial history. Furthermore, they are a crucial part of the Greater Middle East Project, a long-term strategic vision that the United States began to articulate after the Cold War and which solidified following the events of September 11, 2001. The aim of this project is to reshape the political, economic, and social geography of the countries in the region, which stretches from Morocco to Pakistan. This initiative has ancient roots and was developed by a group of American diplomats, economists, and thinkers. The initial outlines emerged in the 1990s with the New World Order speech delivered by George H.W. Bush following the collapse of the Soviet Union. This plan evolved into an official project under the leadership of George W. Bush in 2004, which was formalized as the Greater Middle East and North Africa Initiative. The stated goal was to promote democracy and political and economic reforms in the Arab and Islamic world, but the underlying aim was to reshape the map of influence and borders to benefit U.S. hegemony. Additionally, the aim was to connect the target countries to a unified network of economic and security interests, naturally led by Washington, so that this vast region could become an alternative sphere of U.S. strategic influence to ensure its global dominance against China. This project also has implicit goals, particularly the dismantling of major central states like Iraq, Syria, Sudan, Egypt, and Iran into smaller sectarian or ethnic entities to facilitate their control. Additionally, there is a constant goal of ensuring Israel's security by dismantling the powerful neighboring states and transforming the Arab-Israeli conflict from an existential liberation struggle against the colonial power into a mere cultural and developmental issue. This, of course, secures Israel's safety as the primary tool of hegemony over the countries in the region. Thirdly, another implicit goal is to manage energy resources, oil and gas, through subordinate regimes or Western companies. It's important to note that this objective is openly discussed by thinkers, researchers, and some U.S. officials. Fourthly, it's essential to contain China, Russia, and Iran, preventing any Asian-Eurasian axis from competing with Washington in the strategic waterways of the Persian Gulf, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, the Suez Canal, and the Mediterranean. Fifthly, one of the key objectives is also to re-engineer the political and social culture within Arab societies through media, education, and civil organizations. Since the U.S. invasion of Iraq in the spring of 2003, this war has been more than just a territorial or regime struggle. It's been a battle over the very meaning of sovereignty. Iraq was not only invaded by armies, but also by ideas, promises, debts, and structures specifically designed to hinder its recovery. The occupation marked the beginning of a new phase and a different form of American hegemony, where military control evolved into a continuous system renewed through various tools, including military bases, oil contracts, financial influence, and a democracy directed and managed from abroad. Prominent American thinkers point out military force alone does not create legitimacy, and imposing control does not equate to achieving stability. The Iraq that Washington aimed to subjugate is the same Iraq that revealed the fragility of its imperial project when the invasion turned into a strategic burden. However, empires do not easily surrender and always replace their tools with new ones that allow them to maintain their overall dominance, albeit in different ways than before. Today, more than two decades after the fall of Baghdad, the most pressing question remains: has Iraq truly freed itself from occupation, or has its captivity merely been reconfigured within a global system that denies it full sovereignty? The answer is not straightforward. The United States will not allow Iraq to easily respond to this question through complete liberation and genuine independence without resistance. However, it is true that the journey towards true independence is not solely measured by the withdrawal of armies, but by the ability of people to break the chains of hegemony, whether they are visible or hidden. I'll see you next week, inshallah, for a new episode.
AM, waking up for Fajr. Gotta make wudu, gotta pray my sunnah. Got me ghusl, gotta clip my nails. Looking outside, the sun is rising. Up in the sky, everybody's rushing. Gotta get down to the masjid. Gotta say salam to the imam. Sitting in the first saf, chilling in the back saf. Gotta make my mind up, do what the prophet did. It's Jumu'ah. Everybody's looking forward to his mercy, mercy. Jumu'ah, Jumu'ah, gotta make thinking on Jumu'ah. Everybody's looking forward to the ajr. Miss Wackim, Miss Wackim, yeah! Miss Wackim, Miss Wackim, whoa! Pray, 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 pray. Gotta read Surah the Kahf. 12:45, the imam's on the minbar, talking about something like fiqh as a cat. They're whispering, chatting from the crowd. Don't they know that it's a haram? I stand up, you stand up. Praise about to start by the qamat yusala. Foot to foot, shoulder to shoulder. Just don't step on me. Sitting in the first saf, chilling in the back saf. Gotta make my mind up, do what the prophet did. It's Jumu'ah, Jumu'ah. Gotta make thinking on Jumu'ah. Everybody's looking forward to his mercy, mercy. Jumu'ah, Jumu'ah, gotta make thinking on Jumu'ah. Everybody's looking forward to the ajr. Miss Wackin, Miss Wackin, yeah! Miss Wackin, Miss Wackin, whoa! Pray, 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 pray. Gotta read Surah the Kahf. It's Jumu'ah, Jumu'ah, gotta make thinking on Jumu'ah. Everybody's looking forward to his mercy, mercy. Jumu'ah, Jumu'ah, gotta make thinking on Jumu'ah. Everybody's looking forward to his mercy.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, presents.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z here on Iron Beings Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And yeah, we see the so presence, talking about presence, well, presence in the sense of also something very beautiful and quite important in Islam. We are told that it's one very nice way of sort of strengthening our ties with our fellow believers, and whether it's with family members or whether it's with friends, work colleagues, or even neighbors. So this is something that is definitely very beneficial. And obviously when we get presents for people, and the presents do not necessarily have to have been things that we bought. It's always been the case that we can also sort of make presents. For example, we could choose to bake a cake or bake something or prepare a beautiful meal for someone to give it to another family, to give it to our neighbors. These are also presents. All that counts. But obviously, the other thing with buying presents for people is it also shows that, yeah, obviously, we have one trait, and that, well, obviously we're thinking about other people, so we're sort of kind towards others, we're aware of their needs, but also it's being generous, basically. It's sort of a sense of sort of also our charity towards others by giving, whether we're sort of donating things or whether we're giving presents to people, it's all giving. And it's all very beautiful. So I just want to mention something that one of the famous martyrs from the Holy Fence did, by the name of Ibrahim Hadi. So he was always looking after his friends. And at one point, he bought a large number of shoes. I think these were sort of they were described as sort of walking boots or shoes, or just very sort of sturdy and useful shoes. And he was going to take all of these shoes with him to the front to give to us of his fellow fighters there, basically, to help them out. Welcome back to A to Z here on Iron Beings Radio, me, Sister Zainab. I'm talking about the idea that obviously we give presents, and I've just mentioned that the famous martyr from Holy Fence, Ibrahim Hadi, for example, had bought lots of shoes for his fellow soldiers at the front, because obviously you can imagine having useful, robust and comfortable shoes at the front is very important. So, you know, this is, and obviously this is something that is very useful. Look, and when we get presents for other people, so whether it's just because we were passing a shop and we randomly remember that, oh, maybe my husband or my wife or my child or my friend likes things like this, and we just go in and get something because we've seen something that they really love. And so no matter what, obviously it depends on financial situation. It doesn't even have to be expensive anyway. But that just shows that we're listening to the people around us, especially those who are close to us. We know their needs, we know what they like, and so they're in our mind, which is something very good. And obviously that then extends. So this is not, so then, for example, so it's not just randomly, so just ad hoc, just in the spur of the moment, basically, thinking, oh, they'd like this, let's get this for our friend, or whoever it is. But also, for example, if we've gone on a trip, if we've been traveling, especially if we've been, for example, away from our local town, if the people have also been to other cities or even other countries, it's lovely to bring things back. And obviously people really enjoy souvenirs, a little presents from other places. And it's not always so much about what it is that we bring back. It's also about the fact that, well, that person went away and they still thought of us. They still had us in their mind. So, you know, I pray that this is, if we haven't done this ourselves, if we maybe go away and we, you know, we don't have those thoughts in our mind, well, maybe even if we just do it once, because obviously remember, if we do something like that once and then maybe even a few more times, gradually we could establish a habit of, you know, just considering some of the people around us and bringing things for them. So let's have the habit of getting presents, of making presents for people around us, inshallah. So that was it for today, and I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on Iron Beings Radio with me, Sister Zainab, and farewell for now.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
When you travel to a historical city, the goal is not just to visit museums and beautiful monuments, but you want to mix with the locals and learn about their traditions and culture. In recent years, many historical houses in Iran have turned to accommodation places, which are called Bumgardi. These are neither hotels nor hostels. They are local traditional houses that provide the opportunity for their guests to meet with locals and live like locals, even for a short time. Nartiti is the first house we visited, a beautiful place in the small town of Taft, with several traditional elements. An Iranian Zoroastrian couple owns the house. Traveling also means doing activities that we would not have done elsewhere. Each night, all the travelers who stay in this cozy place meet with the owners of the house, drink tea, and eat freshly picked pomegranate from the backyard. And so, they can experience a little different trip and realize that we all share the same fundamental values and same objectives. We're all part of the same planet, and this makes us stay connected.
Staying at these kinds of places adds to one's understanding of the world and understanding of people. It is something which gives you an understanding that all of us are the same. We're all people. We're much more similar than we are different. And when you start taking governments and other things out of the situation, it's just, we can enjoy being with each other and understanding each other and learning about each other.
Another differentiating element of this house is a wall full of memories of those who stayed a while in this place. A very interesting wall that takes you to a journey around the world.
Une nuit dans cette maison, particulièrement,